Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, fires raging in the West. Since the beginning of August, record-breaking fires have burnt millions of acres across California, Oregon, Washington State, and Idaho. A combination of dry land, hot temperatures, and strong winds created conditions for what scientists are calling an unprecedented fire season. The billowing smoke and ash have resulted in some of the worst air quality conditions in the world in these states. Kendra Pierre Lewis reports on climate change and its consequences. She's currently senior reporter on the podcast, How to Save a Planet. I talked to her about what we're seeing and if this is the future. Kendra, can you give us a sense of the scope of the fires on the West Coast right now? How many are we talking about? How massive are they?
As of end of day on September 16th, there were 79 active large fires across 10 Western states. And that's not every fire that's happening in the West. These are the ones that are big and sizable and potentially represent a real threat. California had the most fires with 22, followed by Idaho with 13, Oregon with 12, and Washington with 11. So far this year to date, nationwide, we've burned just under 7 million acres.
It's just mind-boggling to think of that. Kendra, we've seen fires before on the West Coast. We've seen them in Australia. We've seen them in many parts of the world. How are these fires different?
Mostly just the scale and intensity of them, and also the timing. Increasingly, scientists think that California in particular has two wildfire seasons, one in the summer, which tends to burn the backcountry and places that are far away from where people live, and then one in the fall where it's wind-driven. And what happened this year, especially in California, is because of these lightning storms, you kind of got the what's traditionally considered the fall fires, like these big fires near where people live in the middle of summer. And what's driving it, what's underpinning all of this is climate change, essentially, because California is drier than ever. And we know this from like hanging clothes to dry. When it's hotter outside, your clothes dry faster. And California is hot and getting hotter, and that's drying out all of the vegetation, all of the plants, all of the trees, all the grasses, all the brush, and it's making it easier when a condition lights a match, whether that's a lightning storm or, you know, the 2017 fires, the Tubbs fire was linked to electrical wires. When something acts as a trigger, it will catch fire much more easily. You know, I'm in New York City, it's pretty wet here right now. So I could go into my backyard, I'm lucky enough to have a backyard, and drop a match in my backyard, and it's not going to catch fire, it's too wet. But if I were to do that in California or in Oregon right now, that would be a nightmare.
I had dear friends in Oregon, in Portland. He has wet down his entire roof and is going to take his family to Washington State. How bad is it in Washington State?
The fires are just consistent along the West Coast, unfortunately. The West Coast had literally the worst air quality in the world for much of last week. It varies a little bit with the size of the fires, but it's not good. And oftentimes people think that the fires somehow magically stop at the border, but they don't. So it's California, it's Oregon, it's Washington, but it's going up into Canada and British Columbia. It's bad. I mean, six of California's largest fires in history happened this year. I just want to put that in context for you.
And it's not just the fires, it's the smoke and how people's breathing is affected.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of literature on how like this kind of fine particulate pollution is just not good for your health. And in California, especially in Northern California, there's an added wrinkle where a lot of people are in, you know, it's warm, it's summer, and people are trapped in these homes where they can't open the windows because of the fires, but many people don't have air conditioning either. So they're stuck in these very hot houses, literally struggling to breathe.
How many of these fires are man-made? That is, someone taking a match and dropping it. And how many of them are simply natural disasters.
Most fires in the United States are started by humans, but that doesn't mean that most people are arsonists. Like, that isn't what happens the vast majority of the time. Generally, we're, as a species, we are just excellent fire starters. You know, I can give you a list of things that can ignite a fire if it's under the right conditions. Quite famously, there was a garbage truck that apparently garbage trucks periodically, the garbage catches fire. And so he had taken the waste and dumped it in a field of grass, and that ignited a big fire because the conditions were correct. During 2017, when the last time Oregon sort of had such big fires, that was the same year as the big solar eclipse. And there were all of these warnings about not parking your car on grass, because parking your car on dry grass, the heat from the undercarriage, if the conditions are right, can start a fire. You know, oftentimes in the Northeast, they turn lawns into parking lots for overflow parking, but like you would never, but that same condition, if the grass is very dry, can ignite a fire. So most cases when they say humans start a fire, they're talking about situations like that and not situations where someone is deliberately going out and arson. And then there's also, you know, I guess there's a category which I would call stupidity, where recently one of the fires started because he did a gender reveal, and the gender reveal party involved some sort of fireworks. That happened this year, but there was another fire 4 years ago, maybe in Arizona, where it was a similar thing where he burned thousands of acres. He had a gender reveal firecracker, and he did it on dry land, and it ended up causing a massive wildfire. So those are all under human caused wildfires, but none of those people, like, that wasn't their goal, was not to start a fire. It's just the conditions were so good. And that's partly one of the reasons why California has traditionally burned so much, is because it's such a heavily populated state. So you have a high concentration of people in a landscape that is conducive to fire, and people are conducive to fire. And so you're going to get some of this sort of kind of combustion. What was interesting this summer, though, is that first suite of fires that really captured people's attention, those were dry lightning. A person didn't start them. Those were weather. It was lightning. And it was atypical. It was unusual. It was completely, researchers aren't really clear about why it happened. But normally on the East Coast, when we had a lightning storm, it comes with rain. But they did not get the rain, they only got the lightning, and those lightning strikes, when they hit dry plants, was enough to cause a fire.
Many of the fires right now seem to be in populated areas that have burned before. Has anyone said, let those areas burn, because otherwise it's just going to keep happening?
It is, I don't think, possible really to say, you know, let them burn, right? What does happen is when wildfires kind of break out in places where that isn't happening, where people aren't impacted, increasingly they're letting those burn. They keep an eye on them to make sure that they're not encroaching on populated areas, but they let them burn out, because the other ingredient to like why the fires are so bad is in 1910, there was a massive, massive, massive wildfire. I think it burned 3 million acres across the West in 48 hours, something like that. And after that, it's called the Big Burn. A lot of people say that this year has a lot of parallels to that year, but we've already burned more than the Big Burn did, although it took longer. And that ushered in an era of fire suppression. And that ushered in this rule where if you spotted a fire today, it had to be out by 24 hours the next day. And the problem with that, especially out West, is those are fire-adapted ecosystems. So they're supposed to periodically burn. The indigenous people traditionally burn those lands from year to year. And when you burn those lands, the brush and the understory and the things that are super, super easy to catch fire, they go out. The big trees stay behind, obviously, because, you know, they've got bark, they can withstand it. And you don't build up the kind of, they call it fuel load. You're not building up the kind of things that can fuel these big, big, big fires. And so for almost 90 years, we pretty strongly pursued, especially at West, a policy of fire suppression. And that has created conditions so that when, because of climate change, the conditions are so great for fires, there's lots of stuff to burn. So they're kind of mixing together. But the one thing to also remember is that not everything that is burning is a forest, both partly because some of what's burning is in like the foothills, like the wildland urban interface, where people like near wild areas, near forests. But then there are also grasslands and brushlands, and those are also burning. And that's why I keep deliberately saying wildfires and I'm not saying forest fires, because not everything that's burning is a forest.
I see. What about the role we humans are playing in the eruption of these fires, for example, where we choose to live?
Yeah, it is a combination of where we choose to live. But the thing that's also, and it was really beneficial for me to realize, is that some people, it is a choice. They really, really like the way nature looks. They want to be close to nature, and they're making this choice to live in areas that are very close to these high burn areas. But, you know, California is in the middle of a housing crisis, and a lot of people are not necessarily looking for amenities. They're looking for what they can afford. And so it's really helpful to kind of recognize that mix, that and sometimes that mix is even in like the same communities. So like some communities are both, you know, there are people who are living in very large and like lovely houses, and there are people who are just living there and it's like survival housing. And so I think choice is a really interesting word, because those choices are impacted by things like housing policy and local legislation about where people can and cannot build. And so sometimes people are making decisions to live in places that are very tenuous, but that is the best immediate option available to them. And so if we want to fix that, the way to fix that, I think, is not necessarily by villainizing those people, but like taking a step back and looking at the whole frame and the whole context under which they're making that decision and giving them better options. So like in California, there's a bill floating through about allowing duplexes on single family homes. Like me and you, we're very used to duplexes. But in a lot of California, the zoning doesn't allow for two family houses on a single family plot. And so you can have some of that infill, and that will ease up some of that housing pressure and maybe make it so that fewer people are moving into the wild and urban interface.
Well, another thing you talked about is how we have managed fires in the past, mm-hmm. as compared to what we're doing now and what we're seeing now. Compare, if you can.
Yeah, so there was a period of, like, as I alluded to earlier, like intense fire suppression where everything got put out, and we're moving away from that era. But the gap that I think exists is not between, like, I think most of the experts are on board about what we need to do in many ways. There are some questions about the best and most effective way to do that, given the fact that we're in a more flammable era. But I think the gap is in public understanding, because we just do such a really good job of vilifying fires that the idea of good fire is really anathema to a lot of people. They're like, what are you talking about? All smoke is bad, all fire is bad. And that's not true. And so I think that that's a component that we really need to bring back, is like public outreach, and, you know, and that fire is a tool as much as it can be a really damaging thing.
Do you see some areas moving to that kind of thinking?
I mean, the southeastern United States does a ton of prescribed burning, like a ton. They are the first, Florida was the first state to be like, we're burning. We don't care about the official mandate. We're bringing back prescribed burn. California is starting to move in that direction, but, you know, it's hard. It's the most populated state in the country. Like, there are people everywhere. It's, you know, and so like there are tensions there. It's not like you can flip a switch and overnight just start burning land. So I would say, you know, there was an awareness there that isn't where the roadblocks are anymore. I mean, from an institutional perspective, the governor of California just signed like a memorandum of understanding about it. But like, you know, this year was not a good year for burning, right? Because it was so dry in the north, and it was so dry for a really long time before the rains came. And then there was also a pandemic. So like, that's the thing, right? It's like, there are no easy solutions. It's got to be holistic. It's got to be complicated. It's got to be a mix of things. Probably some people will need to move, but that means finding places they can move to. We absolutely need to do more burning, but burning alone isn't the ultimate solution. It's just a lot more thinking holistically about what should be on the land.
A short break, then we'll be back with more of my conversation with Kendra Pierre-Lewis.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Kendra Pierre Lewis. She's senior reporter on the podcast How to Save a Planet from Gimlet and a former climate reporter for the New York Times. You talked earlier about climate change. I want to ask you about determining the link between the breakout of fires and climate change.
Yeah, so we know that a hotter, drier world is a more combustible world. And California and the West, two things are happening. They are getting hotter and drier just like everywhere else is. And there are also shifts in their seasonal precipitation. Basically, what that means is they're going through bigger drought and wet periods. So the drier years are drier, and it seems in California that the wetter years might be wetter. So it's not that they're necessarily getting less rain. It's just that it's coming at a different time. And so those dry years, like right now, it's very easy for things to catch fire. The other thing that's not really appreciated about the wet years, and this is sort of what they think is happening in Oregon, is what's happening in Oregon is their winters are getting wetter and their summers are getting drier. And that doesn't sound like it should be a problem, but it is, because what happens in the winter, you get all of that beautiful rain. And remember, Oregon isn't really, especially coastal, like, or Western Oregon, isn't really that cold. Is you get these beautiful rains that feed all of these beautiful grasses that then immediately dry out because your summers are hotter and drier, and they become excellent fuel. And so what's happening in Oregon is a little bit different than what's happening in California, which is it does appear that Oregon's, especially Western Oregon's, ecology is shifting as a result of climate change. Just like I live in New York City, and we just became officially, I think, subtropical.
Subtropical.
Yeah, we were once humid continental, and now we're officially subtropical climate zone.
So what does that mean?
We're hotter and moister. You know, practically speaking, we don't get as much snow as we used to get. I remember the blizzard of 96. I didn't realize that it was going to be like the last good snowstorm. But it kind of feels that way sometimes. But yeah, basically means that our winters are milder and that we're hotter.
Now, at the same time, at the other end of the country, we're having these hurricanes and floods. Are the two phenomena in any way connected?
I mean, they're connected by climate change. So what's happening with the hurricanes in particular is that the ocean's warmer, and a warmer ocean is hurricane fuel. Traditionally, hurricane season was June 1st through November 30th. And that's because that was when the waters on the Atlantic were warm enough to fuel a hurricane. We had our first named storm this year before the official start of hurricane season, because if the conditions are right, you're still going to get a hurricane. And the conditions, especially this year, were quite right. It was very, 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 very warm in the ocean. We've been lucky, I think, in that it's been bad. You know, like Laura has been pretty bad for the people who were hit by Laura. And I think we're still sort of sussing out the impacts of Sally. It hasn't been horrifically, horrifically, horrifically catastrophic. It's just been, and I don't mean to minimize this, bad. And the thing that I think really sticks out to me is almost, in the case of Laura, almost immediately after Laura moved out, the Gulf states, that same region, got hit by a heat wave. And so you had 200, 300,000 people without having to deal with the heat wave without electricity, because that electricity had been knocked out by Laura. And this was happening while the West Coast was on fire and while we were in the middle of a pandemic. So we're talking about disaster on top of a disaster on top of a disaster. And so one of the things that I don't think, and that I don't think I've talked about this enough, I think more of us need to talk about this, is that we do need to do things to adapt and to prepare people for a warming world. That means if you're living in a place where hurricanes hit very often, we need to do things around building and planning and zoning and community building and all of these things. And that's true. But we also need to be investing way more in emergency planning and emergency preparedness than we've been investing in.
This may be out of your line of thinking, but I wonder whether a warmer world might indicate more problems with pandemics like the one we are currently seeing.
So there's some evidence that it might. So there are kind of two pathways. One is just that the way we get pandemics, like the one we're living in, is through human-animal interaction, right?
Right.
And in a warmer world, we're not the only ones that are going to be moving because it's uncomfortable. Animals will be moving because it's uncomfortable. And so there will just naturally be a lot more human animal interactions. And that, and you know, we're not talking about your puppy, we're talking about like with wild animals, and that, and those interactions, if you, the more of those interactions you have, the more likely you are to bump into something that is carrying something that can jump to humans.
I want to ask you about the people fighting these fires out west. How are they faring? This has got to be such a difficult job, especially in light of the pandemic.
I wrote about this in March, that when I was saying that scientists were saying that it was going to be a problem in March, I joked that I had the receipts because I wrote this story in March about how COVID could make fighting the fire more difficult. And one of the ways that it makes it more difficult is traditionally the way everything you do to fight a fire, you do in teams. You go out in buses of 10 or in 20. You are working in a team environment. And now it means way more testing. Normally they set up like a team tent. Some of these big burns can have, you know, upwards of 1,000 people working on them. So they'll have like a central mess hall where everyone goes in and eat. And they can't really do that. So there's been a lot of thinking. It's been a lot more like pod formation where people are more closely aligned with their teams and not with other people, because you want to minimize the interactions between groups. I'm not in California, I'm in New York, so I haven't heard a lot from people on the ground. But I imagine they're really struggling. The fires aren't going to go out until the rains come.
Right. And how many people, both firefighters and ordinary citizens, have we lost because of the fires?
Over 40 at this point, but we won't know for a while because there are places you can't get in. Like you still can't get in to count. So there are lots of people who are missing, and we won't know the death toll until some of the big fires are out, or until they've moved past the point where people can get into those communities and start searching for people.
So now I'd like to ask you about presidential candidate Joe Biden and his response, as well as Donald Trump's response to the fires. What are they saying, and what do you see coming from each of them about their thinking on these fires?
Trump basically is placing most of the blame on the state of California. He routinely refers to them as forest fires, even though I alluded to they're not just burning in forests. And he basically says that, you know, California's mismanaged its forests, and that's why it's on fire, and that these fires don't happen in other places, and it'll be getting cooler soon.
Is there any truth to that?
57% of forested land is actually under federal control in California. California, the state, only directly controls 3% of its forested lands or its wildlands. So even if the mismanagement argument is true, then that blame should fall on the federal government and not on the state of California, since the vast majority of it is under federal control. As I alluded to earlier, these fires are not just limited to California, and not just limited to the United States. We just lived through Australia's kind of epic wildfire season last year. We've already forgotten about the Greek fires of 2018. We've forgotten about the France wildfires of 2017. I think it was 2010 or 2012 where Russia was just like completely enveloped in fire for quite some time. So it's a global phenomenon. It's not an American one. And while historical practices may have exacerbated the conditions that we're facing right now, the big driver is climate change, which President Trump doesn't accept the science on, in contrast to Vice President Biden, you know, who has called Trump a climate arsonist and has actually developed a comprehensive climate plan. The thing that I think kind of gets lost in both of their back and forth is a recognition that, you know, climate change is here and we have to live with it. And what we're really fighting for is the degree to which it gets worse. People often throw around the phrase that this is the new normal, and that is incorrect because we are still emitting greenhouse gas emissions. And so we're on the runway and we're trying to decide how fast we want to go because it can get worse. So as bad as it is now, there's enough warming sort of locked in the system that it's going to get incrementally worse for a while anyway. But the question is, how much worse do we want it to get, right? Like, do we want it to be 10% worse, or do we want it to be 150% worse?
President Trump said he believes things will get cooler.
Yeah, he said it. And I listened to it 3 or 4 times, the video, and I couldn't figure out if he was saying winter was coming or if he meant the climate well, it's getting cooler. The climate is definitely not getting cooler. There's no disagreement among climate scientists about that. It is true that winter is coming, and sort of objectively, it will get cooler because of winter. But the thing that I say in response is that winter is coming, I guess, and it will get cooler because that's what happens when winter comes. But our winters are actually hotter than they've ever been before because of climate change, winters are warming much faster than summers. So we don't notice it as much because when it's 90 degrees and it's all of a sudden it's 100, you notice that, like that difference really sticks out at you. But when it's 35 degrees and all of a sudden it's 45, you're just like, oh, I'm a little bit more comfortable. So you don't notice it in the same visceral way. But winters are actually getting much warmer.
In your mind, how much of this issue of climate change, the fires we've seen, the floods we've seen, how much of that do you think is going to be in people's minds as they go to vote in this election?
Oh, I wish I knew. I don't know. And I don't know partly because my wonder or my worry or my concern is that the people who are most directly impacted by these, because they're indirectly have been directly impacted by this, they won't actually be able to vote. They'll be so busy dealing with the fallout of the impact these catastrophes have had on their lives that voting will, and I'm not judging them, will not be high on their agenda, right? Like if you're holding on for survival, everything else kind of takes a lower priority. And then everybody else is sort of, you can turn it off. I think that's the interesting thing about being a climate reporter is that even though I'm not directly, you know, I'm very lucky that I have not been hit this year by a climate calamity. I don't have the luxury of turning it off. I'm the one who's talking to these people. I'm the one that's constantly reading the reports. I'm the one that's watching it kind of nonstop. But I think everyone else in my situation can look at California and can be like, oh, well, that's really sad. And they can turn it off in a way. And that reality, it is a reality, means that I can't even pretend to have a crystal ball to know how much people are internalizing what they're seeing and having that be a reflection of how they choose to cast their ballot.
You seem to be saying that we're going to have to learn to live with these kinds of natural disasters.
Natural hazards.
I'm glad you corrected me.
Emergency managers don't like the phrase natural disaster because weather is natural. So a hurricane is natural. A tornado is natural. What turns it into a disaster is that it hits humans, right? That's when it becomes a disaster. A tornado that doesn't tear down your home or go through a town is just weather. You know, there's lots of fun videos on YouTube of tornado chasers, and we never hear about those tornadoes because they didn't hurt anyone. And how we structure society, where we choose to live, the policies we put into place, those are the things that turn weather into a disaster. And so we want to be careful and recognize that there we have agency in that.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, you are probably going to face some sort of extreme weather event, and you should probably be thinking through how you're going to handle it. We did a whole episode on disaster preparedness. It's kind of a thing that we're going to continue doing because like I'm saying, we need to adapt and we need to recognize that this is the reality of the world that we're living in. I packed a go bag for the first time ever this year because I looked at what was coming. I knew it was going to be an active hurricane season. I knew it was going to be an active wildfire season. It was almost impossible to get emergency managers on the phone in March because of the pandemic. And my immediate reaction is when bad things happen, there's going to be limited help to go around. Just functionally because of where we are in the world, and I started packing a disaster bag.
You're saying no matter where we live,
mm-hmm.
whether it's in the middle of the country or on either coast,
mm-hmm.
prepare yourself.
Right. And your emergency manager will know the disaster that is most likely to befall you, the hazards that are most likely to befall you. So obviously, if you're in Iowa, maybe you're not preparing for a hurricane, but there are other things that you need. You're probably preparing for flooding and tornadoes. There are things that you need to prepare for, and you need to start thinking that.
Kendra, thank you so much for everything you've helped us learn today. And thank you for all your work on this subject. I hope you keep on writing for a very long time.
Thank you so much for having me, and this has been a great conversation.
That was Kendra Pierre-Lewis. She is senior reporter on the podcast How to Save a Planet from Gimlet. and a former climate reporter for the New York Times. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like us to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruttenberg and Ben Lansberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.